Diversity.
Yes, of course, confusion.
Oh, trash is bored.
Well, hello everyone. Sorry for the delay. I was actually delayed because I wanted to make sure I got a few little details about the European Union correct before I have my opening spiel here, before we get to the super thanks and the super chats. It's actually been quite a long time since the last office hours. How long exactly? Let us check. I've been away, of course. I've been on holiday. I like business as usual, and I don't like holidays usually. But this is actually the first office hours since the 1st of July. Ladies and gentlemen, the 1st of July. It is now the 29th of July, which means there is a metric fuck ton of super thanks to catch up with. And super chats, of course. So let us not waste any time. Now, I've called this stream Europe Needs Independence from America. And the reason I've called it that is because Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission, has just signed one of the worst trade deals possibly in the history of trade deals. I mean, I'm reminded of some of the deals that the British Empire used to sign with various kind of smaller powers back in the 19th century. I'm reminded, for example, of the deal that they signed with the King of Persia on the Anglo-Persian oil deal, where it was like, you know, monopoly rights to drill oil in Iran. Nobody else is allowed to drill, and you get 6%. You know, that was like a really one-sided, horrible deal from the Iranian point of view, right? I'm reminded of that sort of deal. I mean, von der Leyen has not just cucked. She has not just kind of surrendered, basically, to Trump. She's given away everything, absolutely everything. And one of the countries to really, really, really get buggered over in this is Germany. Okay, that they're already talking about it costing German car manufacturing possibly $1 billion or €1 billion. Sorry. Okay, Germany was planning to build this kind of military industrial complex. You know, do you remember Merz was saying, "Oh, we're going to make our own arms and all of that." Von der Leyen signed all of that away, pledged to buy arms from Trump. 15% tariffs in exchange for zero tariffs the other way. 15% going into America, 0% coming the other way. Okay, I mean, this is, talk about imperialism. This is, it's shocking. It's absolutely shocking. And it is unacceptable. It is completely unacceptable from the European point of view. And I've been looking at what are the odds. The reason I was late is because I was looking at what the actual practicalities of this deal are and whether it's going to go ahead, because it's that bad. It is that awful. I mean, it's literally not just set to bugger up the European economy, but to bugger it up long term. Okay, this could cause lasting, and I mean lasting, damage to Europe as a whole. Okay, so one of the things I'm looking at is, I mean, if you want to have a look, the BBC ran this article, who are the winners and the losers here. Winner is Trump, obviously. Loser, American consumers. Well, you know what tariffs mean, higher prices, etc. Stock markets in Asia are a winner. European solidarity is a loser. Okay. Car makers in Germany, billion euros. Big pharma in Europe is a loser. They've signed over to buy American energy to tie in with that after they bugger themselves up over Nord Stream, if you remember. Okay, so basically, von der Leyen signed a deal where Europe gets nothing. It's literally the Willy Wonka meme. You lose. Good day, sir. You get nothing. You get nothing. Okay? It's awful. It is one of the worst things I think I've ever seen. Okay? And I then started to get interested. Well, like, okay, what is the power that Ursula von der Leyen has? And what are the odds that this gets overturned? And one of the reasons I was late is that I asked Grok to calculate the odds of this being overturned. And after much deliberation, Grok came back and said this has a 51% chance of not being ratified. Okay. Now, in order to understand the structure of the European Union, we first have to understand what the various bodies are and what their powers are. Okay. Now, it just so happens that a couple of days ago, I made a video outlining the structure of the Soviet Union, ladies and gentlemen. If you haven't watched that video, it's 47 minutes long. You'll have a political orgasm listening to that, getting into the weeds of, you know, how the presidium of the Supreme Soviet interlocked with the Council of Ministers and the Politburo. Oh, it's brilliant. It's basically like politics porn. So you should watch that, especially if you're in Britain. Now that porn's been banned, you're going to have to get off on me talking about the structure of a defunct communist regime. But why do I bring that up now? Because it is relevant, okay? It's relevant. Here is the structure of the Soviet Union, okay? Now, if you remember, there was the Politburo, okay? The Central Committee, and then on top of that, the Politburo. On top of that, there's the General Secretary. That was Stalin. Stalin, okay? Then there was the Council of Ministers, on top of which was the Premier, okay? In the early days, that was Lenin. For a long time, it was Molotov, Comrade Molotov of cocktail fame, okay? And then you have the Supreme Soviet, of which there's an elite body called the Presidium. And then there was the chairman of the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet, okay? For the longest time, that was Comrade Kalinin. Kalinin, okay? So you've got the three different power roles in the Soviet Union, okay? Now, why am I talking about this with regards to Ursula von der Leyen, okay? Well, if it's not already obvious, ladies and gentlemen, it's like the EU basically cribbed the Soviet system. It's exactly the same. Right? If you want to try to understand it, the European Commission, of which Ursula von der Leyen is the president of the European Commission, is literally the Central Committee and the Politburo. She's like Stalin. She's like the General Secretary, okay? Then, I mean, look, there was the Council of Ministers in the USSR. There's also the Council of Ministers in the EU. Right. And it's literally called the Council of Ministers, too. If you have a look at this one, the Council of Ministers, right? The Council of Ministers, of which there was a premier. And that has a president as well. And I'm trying to remember who the president it was. Donald Tusk for a long time, wasn't it? It was Donald Tusk. was it Donald Tusk or was he the other one? Anyway. So there's the Council of Ministers, and then there is the Supreme Soviet, aka the European Parliament, full of MEPs. And what's amazing, ladies and gentlemen, is that if you watch my USSR video, the Council of the Supreme Soviet was like a sham democracy that just rubber stamped decisions made by the Politburo. And if you have a look at the history of the European Parliament, it basically does act as a rubber stamping department of whatever it is that Ursula von der Leyen or Juncker or whatever these arseholes were before them decide. Okay? It is handed down from the Politburo and then rubber stamped by the European Parliament. However, unlike, right, yeah, Tusk was the president of the Council of Ministers. Von der Leyen is the president of the Commission. the Politburo, okay, and then there's another, there's the one of the parliament, the Kalinin figure, whose name I forget now. It's anyway, it doesn't really matter who these people are, okay? What matters is how, right, if we are to imagine that the various members of the EU are actually unhappy with this dog shit, and I mean it's dog shit deal that von der Leyen has signed, how are they going to overturn it? How are they not going to do it, okay? Well, one of the ways is through this council here, okay? So to explain how it works, the European Commission is basically a bunch of bureaucrats in Brussels. You know, when they talk about, when Nigel Farage used to talk about the bureaucrats in Brussels, he's talking about this commission, okay? They are basically installed. They are like the Politburo, okay? But in theory, they don't have power just to bring things into law, okay? It has to be passed by both the Council of Ministers and voted on by the European Parliament, aka the Supreme Soviet, okay? Now, that Council of Ministers consists of 27 member nations, and they tend to send their foreign minister, or if it's a trade matter, they might send their minister of trade or interior minister or something like that. And basically, if this thing has to pass, I think it has to pass unilaterally, like it has to pass unanimously. That is, all 27 nations need to agree on this deal. Otherwise, it is null and void, okay? And this is where there's hope, okay? This is where there's hope, because two countries have made a bit of a song and dance about the abject performance of von der Leyen, okay? And those two people are Emmanuel Macron and Viktor Orban. France are very, very, very unhappy with this. And so they should be, as a proper country, as a sovereign nation, as a country with ambitions to walk alone in the world, okay? And so is Viktor Orban, who, even though he's a mate of Trump, has to also look out for the interests of Hungary, okay? So France, the French Prime Minister, who's a man called François Bayrou, he commented, "Your mother was a hamster." No. He commented, he said, "It is a dark day when an alliance of free peoples brought together to affirm their common values, to defend their common interests, resigns itself to submission," he said, okay? And Viktor Orban said, "Trump ate von der Leyen for breakfast," okay? This is a problem. This is a huge problem for the EU, okay? So, in theory, and I'm going to stress in theory, because in practice, it's very much like the Soviet Union with von der Leyen as Stalin and all of those other bodies as sham rubber stamping exercises carrying out the will of the dictator, right? But in theory, the European Council can basically just not ratify this. Okay, this deal that von der Leyen has signed with Trump is not actually official yet. It hasn't been rubber stamped. So there could be pushback from the Council of Ministers, right? The Minister for France could say, "Well, look, we've got a problem with this." Viktor Orban could join, and now you've got a problem because not all of the 27 member states agree. And then, even if they do agree, it has to go to the European Parliament and win the vote in there. Okay, so it needs to be ratified twice, once by the Council of Ministers and once by the MEPs who sit in the European Parliament. When I ask Rock, it put the chances of that happening at 51-point-something%. So Grok, at the very least, believes it is possible, given the stances of France, etc., that this is going to be overturned. Such as the costs of it, I wouldn't be that surprised if it was overturned, because it's that bad. Now, some people have talked about von der Leyen being removed. Okay, now there is a mechanism to remove von der Leyen. Okay, how can she do it? They can pass a vote of no confidence, okay? And she's already faced a vote of no confidence last week, or 2 weeks ago, okay? They in the European Parliament, they submitted quote-unquote hard-right MEPs, basically put up von der Leyen for a vote of no confidence to try to bring it down. And she won the vote, right? She won the vote. But people are saying it's her absolute last chance, okay? The votes were, out of 720 MEPs, 553 turned up. They needed 360. 175 voted in favor. And 360 MPs voted against. So she had the majority. But, and this is a big kind of, you know, I mean, I'm not saying this is going to happen. I'm just saying if she is defeated on the deal that she signed with Trump and everybody decides, like, we cannot go ahead with this because this is economic suicide for Europe, okay? There is a mechanism that they basically stick her up for no confidence again. And remember, there are already 175 who want to get rid of her. Okay, they only need an extra 115, what was it, 150, like 200, like they need to double that number, basically. And it could be that with extra votes who are against her on this trade deal, we could see the end of von der Leyen. Frankly, that is what needs to happen. It's what needs to happen because these people, these puppet leaders of Europe, are you know, they're selling the European peoples down the river, right, for an aggressive, hostile, I would actually say anti-white, you know, imperial project, which is the American one. And if this doesn't wake people up to the need to decouple from America, I don't know if anything ever will. It's a horrible deal. It's an absolutely horrible deal. Anyway, I think that's enough on that. That's enough on that. Because there's so many super chats and super thanks and things that I need to get on with those. Otherwise, we'll never get out of here, okay? But yeah, let me know what you make of all of this. Now, I have to figure out what was the last office hours before I went away. And that will then help me figure out when the last super thanks was. Okay, the absolute fakery of modern politics. That was back when Scrump and Evelyn were launching their book. So when was that? Let's have a look. Okay. Steljoes 25 says, thank you, AA. I have been a lurker for just over a year, especially enjoyed the Peoples of Europe book read over 4 weeks or so a while back, and the Adam Curtis stuff. Very thought-provoking. I don't know the right place to ask about this, but do you know where or how one can join the Basket Weavers? Find Mark on Twitter. That's what I would say. Find Mark on Twitter. That has reminded me as well that I've been sent a trailer for this year's WITAN event, which I will play shortly. I will play that shortly. But yeah, find Mark Houghton on Twitter and follow the links and things. Ken Nahara says, what is more critical, ending dual citizenship or immigration? How can people elect someone who can have loyalties to other countries? Well, I think they are equally important, to be honest. I do think the dual citizenship thing is a serious problem, especially when you get organized minorities from, you know, certain other countries coalescing in the government. As I promised, here is the WITAN trailer. Here is a trailer for the WITAN.
In the earliest days of our nation, the herald was sounded for the elite men of England to decide the fate of our country. Such a gathering was known to our forefathers as the Witan. Now, in the ruins of our kingdom, the call has been sounded again. A new rising elite of steadfast men and women have a new Witan. This is the epicenter of the new British right. We shall hear from the heavyweights of our sphere. Carl Benjamin, Ed Dutton, Howard Cox, Nathan Hood, Nina Power, Catherine Blakelock, Josh Firm, and many more inspired speakers. This Witan will surely be generational. Buy your tickets now at shieldings.com.
So there you go. Pick up your tickets to go to the Witan. All right. Let us carry on. So Ian Strax has sent £2 and just says thanks. Son of Leviathan says, great video. This is on why is everybody joining Rupert Lowe's Restore Britain movement. He says, great video. I wanted to ask if you see any importance of theology to achieve political goals. Zionism fundamentally relies on Abrahamic theology to justify its existence as political ideology. And as we've seen, it's been incredibly successful. Why and how can Britain oppose Islam without a British theological foundation of its own? Well, I am the wrong person to ask as somebody who absolutely loathes theology. I'd grant that the number done on that Scofield Bible has been quite successful in America. So I guess it is important, but I'm the wrong person to ask about theology, I'm afraid. Ken Nahara says, South Korea is evidence that the capital failed to use immigration to save the dying state. However, due to capital interests, South Korea will not exist in a few decades. Mass immigration seems to be the result of allowing dual citizenship and consequently dual loyalty rather than capital interests. Yes, that is a point well made. In civilizational terms, North Korea is winning, isn't it? I mean, you wouldn't have said that a few years ago. But it strikes me that just in pure evolutionary terms, South Korea is losing against North Korea. That was on Elon Musk versus the people. That's super chat, super thanks. Raina is back, and this is on an ancient video called Suicide Rates, Materialism, and Religiosity, which was a video about suicide rates during COVID. Raina says, the more educated the population, the greater the suicide rates, decadence, and overall lack of coherent narratives, which is essentially religion. So naturally, North Korea would be the most traditional nation in the world. No internet, low education, and a strong state narrative that is not challenged. As for the Soviet states, it is not unreasonable to assume that the influence of liberal values led to the rise of suicide. Well, I couldn't speak to that, but I do think that the rise of quote-unquote liberal values undid the Soviet Union. But I'll get on to that when I make my Stalin video later this week. Tay-Tay just says thanks on the Rupert Lowe video. Thank you very much, Tay-Tay. What James Lindsay gets wrong about elite theory, a 30-minute expose. James Goodwin says, new viewer to your channel, AA, but I've been working my way through some of the back catalogue and also bought a book. Excellent content. Well, thank you very much, James. I had a question regarding Rupert Lowe. If your vision of him gutting the Tory party and becoming its leader is realised, how do you think it will work within the framework of elite theory? Which elite group is going to back him and what are their incentives? We've obviously seen some signs of it's happening from the mainstream coverage he's been getting, but I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on the why. Yes, basically it is pragmatists within the Tory party machinery who realize that the writing is on the wall and it's a choice between losing the most successful and oldest political party in the world or it's surviving, basically. And people like Michael Gove seem to be the sorts of people who might have that pragmatic mindset. They're not ideological at the end of the day. One of the benefits of believing in nothing is that they will adopt any position, right, in order to survive. So that would be the bet that would have to be made. Whether you think it's worth getting into bed with absolute worms and worm tongues like Gove is another question, but that may be the Faustian gambit that Lo would have to make in order to you know, kick the Tory party into shape. But it would require Gove basically persuading some of those grandees, like John Major, or I don't know if Heseltine is still there and so on, that this, you know, it's basically do this or bust, do this or bust. Also, Robert Jendrick needs to be persuaded that he is not the man. He is too tainted by the previous government. He is too tainted by the stench of regime on him, right? So Jendrick needs to be the J.D. Vance to Lo, not the Lo himself, right? It has to be Lo, can't be Jendrick. Jendrick is too tainted. But it also requires Jendrick coming to realize that himself, that if he tries to take on the mantle, he will be the man in history who leads the Tory party to oblivion, okay? And basically it's that. You don't want to be remembered as the guy who destroyed the Tory party. Sam Osborne says, AA, I was born... So this is very old stream. Cigar stream 152, behind the paywall, British political kayfabe, booking Rishi Sunak into 10 Downing Street. AA. Well, that happened, didn't it? That did actually happen. So turned out to be a prophetic stream, didn't it? Anyway, he says, AA, I was born in 1997. I have never known anything other than the Blairite technocratic globalism, basically. Whilst Blair, Cameron, etc., were voted in per se, I think we can honestly say that their anti-British policy wasn't, and it was insidiously installed. Well, absolutely right, Samo. If you agree with the notion that we never voted for this, what can we really do about it? I'm starting to see the rationale of the notion that we cannot vote our way out of this. Is this too glum? Do we just have to hope and pray for a competing castle with based interest to come about and take reins? Or is there something we can do to help steer the future of this land? As much as I want to back Rupert Lowe and think he's genuine, I can't help but think how every single time something like this comes along, we're just left holding the bag. These are all fair points, Samo. They're all fair points. But what I'm counting on is the logic of the regime to save itself. And in order to save itself, it needs to give concessions. It needs to register what people are actually saying. Otherwise, what you're saying will come true. And maybe it's a necessary step, right? Maybe it's a necessary step, but I don't know. I mean, you know, you'd like to be able to think that the system can self-adjust, that it can self-right. The British establishment has been able to do this several times in the past to avoid revolution, giving concessions. This is how universal suffrage came about. It is how various health and safety laws came about. It is how they staved off communism, right? By allowing labor into the political system. Didn't have a communist state. Instead, your concession was a trade union movement. Okay, so the British establishment in the past was deft at this sort of thing. Now they've got a choice. Do they dig in and go on along this path that nobody likes, or do they start to give concessions? And we've already seen even a figure as brittle as Keir Starmer is starting to have to pay lip service to the views of you and me and everybody else. Golden Age Puritan says, I have heard, this is on another very, very old video, The History and Politics of Modern Iran, a primer. He says, I have heard that in Iran, Japanese no theater is more popular than in any other place besides Japan itself. Well, I've never heard this, Golden Age Puritan. Are there other aspects of Japanese culture especially popular in Iran? Are the mullahs a bunch of weeaboos? I've never heard this Golden Age Puritan. I have no idea whatsoever about the consumption habits of the average Iranian youth. What I can do is I can investigate. I can ask. I can ask some of the younger members of my dad's family. Anybody into Japanese stuff in Iran, and see what they say. Okay, I'll have to come back to you. Rupert Lowe video again. Nathan says, I am generally a huge fan of your content. However, browsing through your old content, you had a Christian council and exuded Anglicanism on the basis that it has no theological reason to exist. This is simply false and rooted in Roman Catholic obfuscations. Traditional Anglicanism restores Western theology, Christianity, to a theology based on parasitics and has a liturgy similar to Lutheranism. A parity of argument, you would have to say that Lutheranism has no theological reason to exist. I am quite unhappy about all of this. Well, as I said earlier on, I have no interest in theology whatsoever. What I do know is that it just so happens that the Anglican Church sprung up, and it just so happens it was exactly on the same side as the British monarchs of the period, Henry VIII, Edward VI, and then Elizabeth I. Right, I remember there was a clergyman called Matthew Parker under Elizabeth who made the Via Media. To me, that smacks of practical, pragmatic, on the ground politics in the time of Shakespeare and a little bit before then as well. It does not speak to it. Like, okay, you could say, well, there's a theological justification for it going black, yada yada yada. To me, it's all post hoc justification for what power wants to do. And this is just, I mean, I have most theology, especially Protestant theology, comes down to what is it that the political unit wanted. I know that will be an unpopular thing to say, but it's just the case. I mean, it just so happens that every time you get a Protestant branch coming out, it walks hand in glove with whoever the power center is, you know. And let's not forget, the Catholic Church was its own power center, and the reason that ended up being expelled from so many countries that went Protestant is because the Catholic Church had become a rival castle to the national governments of those countries, to the monarch or the, you know, the whatever it happened to be. It was causing an issue. The authority of the Pope was getting in the way of the authority of the king. I sell a course here, Foundations of Shakespeare. You can pick up a much lesser known play called King John, where Shakespeare gives him this speech. And a lot of people think Shakespeare was a secret Catholic, right? But he gives King John this speech, basically moaning about the Pope interfering in British politics, in the affairs of the King of England. And, this was an issue. So you can see, okay, there may be theological justifications this way or that way. Right, the Catholics have got their own theology too, don't forget. But at the end of the day, it comes down to power. Power and politics come first in all of these things. That's just something that, I mean, we could agree to disagree, but this is my view, okay? Cigar stream number one, life lessons. Wow. That is an old stream, friend. Guitar and Chief says, after a week without new AA content, I decided to start in on the old cigar streams. You'll never fail to educate and entertain AA. That's why I hope you're having a lovely holiday wherever you are. Cheers from Kansas City. Well, thank you very much. And if you're wondering, I am enjoying a cigar right now. It is a Partagas, a super Partagas, cheap and cheerful. And a lovely cigar it is too. Not quite as nice as the Partagas Aristocrat, if you ask me, if you're into the old C&Cs, but, pleasant, casual smoke for a stream like this. Ne Plus Ultra just says, thanks on Trump torches the MAGA base over the Epstein files video. Hounsel says, hi, AA, what a journey. This is, where is the Tucker Carlson versus Israel first feud going? from a while back. He says, IAA, what a journey. We've learned so much from and with you, and you were absolutely right on target, re-Trump 2024. My question, are you familiar with the Institute of Globalization and Covert Politics, the ISGP studies, and also use a three-establishment model and the circle of elites not so much heard of in our sphere? I would love to hear your take on them. Also, do you know about the Swiss policy research, the SWPRS? They are pretty good on false flags. Both sites recommended. Keep up the good work. Cheers. I have not heard of either of those two bodies. I will have to look them up. I've not come across them myself. Jackson on the Rupert Lowe video says, recently, I have been debating whether to drop my studies in PPP at Durham University. Talks with students are always so senseless, always so detached from reality, and they are especially alienating to a working class man who's grown up in a British shit-old council estate. Being there has taught me so much as a 20-year-old about who operates the media and the regime alike. Idiots! They are all irresponsible and downright incompetent. They have the sense that this way of life and the liberal world order will last forever, that they can do no wrong and always get away with their utter misunderstanding of the public and the people. Nothing surprises me anymore, and I hope to find my place in the army. I believe that to be my place in this world in the coming years. Mass censorship, digital ID, foreign invasion, decadence. It's already over for them. They have lost and we will win. Have a good day, AA. Well, there you go. There's a disgruntled young man for you. Right? If anybody from the British government is listening, that is how young men are feeling in this country today. Okay? And it's not like, it is not down to listening to me or Carl or any other online commentator. Right? It's the old meme. Who made you feel this way? You did. That is the thing that people find alienating. It is the world that you have created. It's not me doing it. It's not any other person online doing it. All they're doing is reflecting how people out there are feeling in this world, how young men are feeling in this world, in this country, through your abject failure. And if you listen carefully to the things I'm telling you, British government, I am giving you the tools and the path necessary to course correct. To course correct. Before it's too late to course correct. You know, I'm telling you the things that a wise and sensible government should do. Instead, what are you doing? Increasing online censorship. Going more and more authoritarian. You turning every 2 weeks. 1 week, you're going to crack down on immigration. The next week, you're going to lock people up for talking about it online. Make up your mind, Keir Starmer. Make up your mind what you want to do. Anyway, let us have a look at some of the super chats now. That was the super thanks. On the super chats, Coney says, why do you think Rothbard is to be considered an enemy these days? Well, I can't say that on air, Coney. And you know that, you imp. I will say that Rothbard has got a lot to recommend him. His book on egalitarianism as a revolt against human nature is still a very good book. And his turning on the Randians means that Rothbard was always more base than the other libertarians. He turned on the Randians for two reasons. One, because of their staunch commitment to that little state in the Middle East. And Rothbard, as a man of principle, would not go there, right? That's good. That's a thumbs up in the Rothbard direction. The other reason is because Randians are hardcore atheists, like really hardcore militant atheists. And they had a problem, the Randians, with Rothbard marrying a Catholic woman. And they wanted Rothbard to leave his wife. Right. He was like, you want me to leave my wife? Are you insane? So that made Rothbard a lifelong enemy of the Objectivists. And I think those two things basically mean that Rothbard gets a kind of honorary pass on many other issues or many other things. However, in the mood I've been in the past month or so, where my friend enemy distinction is incredibly heightened, I still think there are reasons to distrust Rothbard. For example, in his book, and I've got all of Rothbard's books here, and I've read many, many of Rothbard's books. I'm pretty sure I've got them all. I've got his big, thick One Man and State, and I've got his long two-volume economic history, History of Economics from Adam Smith onwards. And one of the things that you can say is an issue with Rothbard is his various defenses of usury and his characterization of the Christian concept of the just price through history, which is actually something from Aristotle on down that was considered a kind of de facto good moral good. Okay, the concept of the just price. Now, I understand economically all of his problems with it, but I think that to be so full-throated in defense of usury, when we've seen what damage usury has done in our societies and in society at large, since the 1890s onwards, and even going back before that, I would say, well, you know, you have to qualify your support for Rothbard with things like that. I mean, I'm not keen on interest, you know, run amok unchecked, right? That's not to say he wasn't based on many things, because he was, okay? Coney says, if not Newton, who do you think is the greatest Briton ever to live? I think there's a strong case for Newton, because he did discover the laws of optics, the laws of motion, and the law of gravitation, invented integral and differential calculus, and completely reformed the Royal Mint. Well, I'd have to think about it, I mean, who is making the Mount Rushmore of Brits without doubt? I mean, I have to put Shakespeare on there. Shakespeare has to be on there. I put Shakespeare ahead of Newton. I mean, we have to put some sort of warrior or king on there, don't we? King Alfred. Charles Darwin's pretty important in history. Brunel would be in contention, wouldn't he? I mean, Newton's in the conversation, don't get me wrong, he's in the conversation. But yeah, I mean, those are some people that come to mind straight away. Coney says, do you think Frank Dakota's estimate of 45 million people starving to death in China's Great Famine is of similar dubiousness to Robert Conquest's Holodomor death toll numbers? I would have to look into that, Coney. I have not looked into that whatsoever. And when you're looking into Soviet stuff, I mean, Mao is barely mentioned. China is barely mentioned in any of those things. Later this week, I will do something on the Stalin stuff I've been reading, because if nothing else, it's really, really interesting just to run the hypothetical. Like, what if everything you know about Stalin is a lie? How do you know what you know, what you think you know about Stalin? What is the evidence for it? What is the edifice of claims made about Stalin built on, right? And I think that's a really interesting thing, which I'll make a video on later this week if people are interested. I've actually sent an email to Professor Grover Fur, whose books I've been reading. I only sent it just before I came on the show, so he hasn't replied to it yet. But hopefully he comes on. I'd really like him to come on. He's a hardcore communist, right? He is a lifelong tanky, basically, right? But he has done things that pretty much nobody else on Earth has done. For example, he picked up The Great Terror, written by Robert Conquest in 1968, of which there are 1,000 footnotes plus in that book. And he went through every single footnote in that book and looked up the original source to double check to see if Conquest was telling the truth or lying about how he was using that source. And he found that Conquest frequently embellished things, took things from not from primary sources, took things out of context because he was spinning a narrative. Really interesting. His book, Grover Fur's book, Khrushchev Lied, is really genuinely very, very interesting. And look, I'm not a commie. I don't particularly like Stalin, right? I have no interest in rehabilitating any of these figures. I don't share any political aims. But what I am interested in is the truth. And what I'm especially interested in is smashing boomer truth, as you know. I believe that most of the history that we've been taught since 1945 is probably made up or massively embellished in some way. And a lot of people do revisionism looking at one of the other great World War II powers. Okay, that's been done to death in a way. But what always interested me is that those same people who doubt everything that's to do with the Germans tend to then just like take all of the claims made about Stalin lying down. Right? They tend to repeat the center-right Robert Conquest line on Stalin. I'm like, how is that right then? And basically all it is that they've not bothered to look because they're not interested in that. They're interested in that thing over there. Okay? And I'm just fascinated by this guy, Grover Fur, who's literally, I mean, he started doing this in the late 60s. It's 2025 now. He's 81. He's still going after all these years. He's written tons of books. He's just like a turbo autist that has spent a lot of time in the 1991 Soviet archives that were opened up after the fall of the Soviet Union. And he's basically like, there's a lot of stuff that's made up, right? And I'm like, well, rather than de facto dismiss this guy, let's look to see what's there. Okay, and one of the things that he does is he just reproduces things that you've read about a million times but never read. Like, for example, have you ever read the transcripts from the Moscow trials? Do you know what was said in them? Or have you always been told, oh, the Moscow trials were a sham, people were tortured there, so we don't need to look at the confessions, and we just need to assume that everybody was innocent, which is what Khrushchev did. Or maybe there was something there. Right? So this is the sort of thing I'm talking about. People love to talk about reason and evidence. What happens if you actually try to find out what is true? What is the evidence? Now this Grover Fur goes pretty far. Like he even defends the gulags. And he even says that there was no reign of terror under Stalin, that people like did not live in fear and things like this. I'm not sure whether I agree with all of his claims like that. But it is really interesting to look at this stuff that you've never looked at. Well, I'll just put it that way. And I'll be honest, his method of just reproducing the primary sources wholesale is pretty effective. It makes you think, oh, hold on a second. Why didn't that mainstream historian, why did they clip that bit out? Why didn't they mention that? Oh, because it goes against the kind of mainstream view. Oh, right. So yeah, it's just very, it's just an interesting kind of like, how do you know anything to be true, you know? Coney also says, when Russia wins the war, do you think it will solve climate change like when it cured COVID by starting the war? Oh, God knows. I have no idea on that. He also says, I highly recommend the ongoing series by Strategy Stuff on the Chinese Communist Revolution. It is very elite theory pilled. Also, is Kotkin on your Stalin reading list? No, I have not come across Kotkin. What I've been doing, is basically trying to find people who are like, how can I put this? Like sources that are completely not in the mainstream, right? Sources that are either being forgotten. Like, for example, there was a book by an American journalist published in 1956 called The Stalin Era by Anna Louise Strong. Okay. She went over there. She spent a lot of time in the Soviet Union. She witnessed things firsthand. She was at the Moscow trials. And after Stalin died, she wrote this book. And in fact, it was even after Khrushchev gave the secret speech, she wrote this book. And I'm just interested, right, to read things before the kind of confluation of narratives forms, right? Like I always say, if you're going to read about World War II history, don't read the book that came out last year or 2 years ago or 5 years ago or in 1999 or something. Read the book that came out in 1955 before all the narratives had been set in stone, right? Read the books by the guys who fought in that war. And it's an eye-opener. Read the books by the people who were there, who witnessed it with their own eyes. And often it's not the picture that you get from later mainstream historians. And one of the things that this Grover Fur does that is very interesting to me, well, you see, the thing is, Hybrid, you can't read a history of World War II before 1945, can you? You can't read a history of World War II before it ended. So it has to be, has to be afterwards. But yeah, I get the point you're trying to make, but one of the things this Grover Fur does is he talks about the construction of the myth of the two monsters, right? The myth of the two monsters. And remember, everything I do basically is some sort of research, ultimately for my magnum opus, the Boomer Truth Regime. Well, what is the myth of the two monsters? It is basically a massive regime-wide concerted effort to tie the figures of Hitler and Stalin together as a twin tyranny, as two different flavors of totalitarianism. Okay, this is your woke left and your woke right, which James Lindsay's still trying to do right now. Okay, what Grover Fur is saying is that no part of this story of the twin totalitarianisms is true. It's basically just made up by Hannah Arendt and court historians like Alan Bullock. I've got this big, thick book that I've had for years by Alan Bullock. I found it on a park bench once, which is called Hitler and Stalin, Parallel Lives. Okay? So what you're meant to do is you're meant to mentally park these two figures, these titanic figures in the middle of the 20th century, Hitler and Stalin, as two absolute embodiments of evil. Okay? Hitler, the slightly higher evil because of who he killed. Okay? But Stalin, also this untrammeled monster. Okay. And think about it now. If you have that as your view, you're basically putting like really narrow limitations on your understanding of the major events of the 20th century. Right? If you view Stalin as just a monster, how can you possibly understand what happened in the Soviet Union? And the same, incidentally, of what went on in Germany. One of the things that's been very interesting since I've been reading all of these guys, these old Bolsheviks like Molotov, for example, is that they did not demonize the Germans. They saw them as realists. They saw them as serious adversaries. They were curious. I'd almost go as far as to say some of them admired the achievements that were going on there. And, there was touch and go there in Russia as to whether they would actually ally with the Germans long term. Of course, there was the Molotov-Ribbentrop pact, but there was even like there was a lot of contact between the two regimes. And it's just all very interesting. That's all. It's all very interesting because how can I put it? It's not the kind of cartoon version of history that you get from watching movies or you know, reading the history book that's on the top of the bestsellers list this week, you know? The Stalin revisionism stuff, I think, is a real, really interesting little rabbit hole that I've kind of, I accidentally fell down it. I was interested in the power structure of the Soviet Union. And then along the way, I came across this guy, Grover Fuhr, and I'm like, oh, this guy's literally spent 20 plus years in the Soviet archives. And he keeps on saying like everything's made up. Right. For example, in Khrushchev Lied, he says Khrushchev makes 61 factual statements in the secret speech. And he says not a single one of them is true. He says not a single thing that Khrushchev says in that speech is true. Right. I mean, it's kind of remarkable what this Fur guy has uncovered. And I don't want to spoil my Stalin video too much, but the figure of Trotsky looms behind a lot of stuff. The bitterness of Trotsky, the schemings of Trotsky, and the lies of Trotsky end up basically becoming Robert Conquest, believe it or not. So that's a long story short. Anyway, Hansel says, we did that one, didn't we? Sorry, I've skipped ahead. Let's have a look at some other super chats. Base Future says, or do you think that YouTube in the UK will get this ID stuff? Probably. I don't see how it won't. I don't see how it won't. Probably will. It already has it, doesn't it? You have to be signed in to watch stuff they deem over 18 already. I think it's been a long-standing thing on YouTube. Occasionally I put a clip in with a bit of violence in it or something, and it gets the over 18 flag, and you have to sign in. Kills your views, basically. Yeah. Marky Sharky's just sent £2. Jackson says, I always get a cold shiver that Soviet-style hierarchies may be inevitable when we have such complex technologies and large populations. Thoughts, AA? Well, if you haven't read The Populist Delusion by me, or The Managerial State by James Burnham, or the book, what's that book I've got over there, where it talks about FDR's USA, the USSR, and the British Empire basically being three Germany, mid-century Germany, being three different super states. What is that book called? Is it called the Three Reichs? The Three Reichs, is it? Is that what it's called? The Three Reichs. What was that bloody book called? I forget what it's called now. It's a book that shows that more or less in World War II, what you've got is three massive superstructures. FDR's USA being a massive managerial, basically centrally managed state, USSR being another one, and Hitler's Germany being another one. Yeah. And that is Managerial Revolution by Burnham as well. Hold on a second. I'm going to find out the name of that book because it's really annoying me now. Hold on. That's it. Sorry, not the Three Reichs. It's called the Three New Deals. Three New Deals. Three New Deals. Basically, that's what that one's about. That fascism in Europe, communism and FDR's New Deal were three different flavors, basically, of New Dealism. Okay. So let's see what else. Let's see what else. $11 Cheese says, good to have you back, EA. Quick thought, at least the government in A Clockwork Orange used the Ludovico technique to reduce crime and make room for political offenders. These buffoons just say deal with it. Yeah, I know, I know. Broman Hank says, be honest, you failed to save the Soviet Union, which has been driving all these videos to on it, right? Excellent video yesterday, by the way, one of your best. Well, thank you very much for that, Broman Hank. Did you mean the Soviet Union one, or did you mean the Hulk Hogan one? Because people like the Hulk Hogan one. Public announcement, says Bramblers Britannica. The Witan is on the 29th to the 31st of August, not October. Apologies for cocking up the ad. So it's at the end of August, not at the end of October. The Witan is in August. It's always been in August. Every year it's been in August. Shameless O'Blaine says, when will our sweet carrot prince return as a guest? Well, when I do these shows, he tends to be in bed, so that may be difficult. Cringe Walker says, incidentally, Cringe Walker, I watched at the behest of Mark of basket weaving fame. He told me that your video with Benjamin Boyce was worth a watch, and I watched a good deal of it. And it was going really well. And then you started talking about theology and I turned it off. So, but it was the first hour or so was pretty interesting. C123 says, cheers, AA, for 5 years of channel memberships, we've come a long way since those pre-channel streams are with Sargon back in 2015-16. Capitalism ho! Actually, C123, I've always had a channel. Even when I did stuff with Sargon back then, I had a channel. It was just a lot smaller back then than it is now. Everybody's got to start somewhere. I think it was 2016 I started. I had about 1,000 subs at the start, like right back then in 2016. And, you know, I did a couple of fairly high-profile streams with Carl back then, which helped me on my way to my first 10,000, I think. People always wonder, like, why are you so loyal to Carl? I'm like, well, like he did. He basically helped put me on the back map like a decade ago. So I don't, you know, we could disagree with one another. You know, I dislike his association with Tommy, as I tell him to his face. But ever, you know, you can disagree with friends. Happy Curse Plague Doctor says, would you do a tier list of British monarchs? That could be a whole stream in and of itself. I mean, off the top of my head, S tier, Henry the Seventh. Henry the Seventh is an S tier. Centralization, eliminating rival castles, long-lasting administrative change, tax efficiency. No man in the history of this country has done more to make Britain an actual state than Henry the Seventh. So he'd be S tier, William the Conqueror, William the First, S tier. I mean, it depends on how you do this, but I mean, if you take into account what happened during her reign, Victoria has to be S tier, as does Elizabeth I. Elizabeth and Victoria also. So those are the four. They're the Mount Rushmores. William the Conqueror, Henry the Seventh, Victoria, Elizabeth I, and Victoria. How's that? F tier, Henry the Sixth, an absolute shithead. Edward the Second is an F. Who else would be F? I mean, it feels wrong. It feels so wrong. But given the rate of decline over her reign, if we're putting Vicky up on the S tier while she was the queen, Well, basically, the reverse Victoria is Elizabeth II. I could hear Apostolic Majesty make the case for Elizabeth II being F tier, because the rate of decline from 1952 to now is just astonishing, really. It's astonishing. Honestly, Charles III opening mosques and saying Salam Alaikum, and Charles III is F tier. Fuck him. Yeah, those are my Fs. Those are my Fs. Okay, let's carry on. King Charles III. What a shithead he's turned out to be. Do you remember? Oh, he could be based. He's read René Guénon. Bullshit. Max Rockenstanky says, will UK have more revolts over the internet bill? I'm not sure if we'll see revolts, but I can see it becoming, it's become very, very, very unpopular very quickly on both the left and the right and in normie world, because it's just a pain. It's just a pain in everybody's backside. Jackson says, yep, the Austrian and the Georgian are distorted men. Absolutely. But you see, in my mind, people have done the German part to death. Nobody looks into Stalin. And that's why I'm interested in it, because nobody bothers to look. Right? I asked the missus. I said, name me one. If I just said to you, name me one thing you know about Stalin. Right? And she said, oh, yeah, he killed 30 million people. Like clock, it was like a kind of Pavlovian response. Stalin killed millions of people. Stalin, 30 million people. That's the only thing anybody knows about him, right? But what if it was a lie? What if Khrushchev lied? What if Khrushchev lied, ladies and gentlemen? Anyway, I don't want to content cuck my later video, so I'll. Pator says 30s and 40s Germany next. Or would that be too clear? I feel like it's been done, right? And I feel like people have real expertise in that area. There's so many authorities on that that you could turn to. I don't really need to do that. Cringewalker says, you forgot to read my question after commenting on the Boyce interview, lol. But second question will be, will you ever stream Disco Elysium? Well, I remember you gifted that to me years ago, didn't you, Cringewalker? And I have not had a chance to play it. Maybe I will. Maybe at some point. The problem I've got, Cringewalker, and I'll tell you the truth, is that once I finish this stream now, I have to drive back home from the lodge to back home to spend time with family. And then by the time AAA is asleep, the day is gone, basically. By the time I've had dinner, you know, watched a bit of TV or whatever, you know, little one to bed, day's gone. I haven't got time to do bloody anything. The only thing I've got time to do is read little bits of Molotov Remembers before I go to bed. Tom says, did you see that Peter McCormack is still reading your books? You should go on his show. He's still a libertarian. He contacted me. Peter McCormack actually contacted me and said, do you want to come on? And I said, well, I'm on holiday. I'll be back next month. So, yeah, I'm up for it. But, you know, when I get back, okay. And Tom says, a while back, you linked a video by Gavin Bobby saying you agree with this summary of what is going to happen. Collapse, balkanization, etc. Is this still the case? I don't remember that, Tom, I'm afraid. I don't remember. I don't know who Gavin Bobby is, and I don't remember linking his video. It's one of possible. It's one possible scenario. I tend to believe. I'm not a tanky. I am not a tanky. I'm just interested in the truth, basically the truth. Cringewalker says, I have noticed over the past few years, the size of European police forces have ballooned to larger than their armies. Any thoughts on this trend? Well, they're certainly not reducing crime, are they? Certainly hasn't helped to reduce crime. So maybe it's just there because they're gearing up to become a police state. There we go. And I think that's it. For all of the super chats. Hopefully you enjoyed this comeback. I'm just easing back in. I really like business as usual, and I don't like holidays, as I've said. But since I've been on holiday, all of my habits, all of my routines, all of my regular schedules have been disrupted, and it's taking time to kind of ease back into it. I'm easing back in, and it's, tell you what, it's frankly exhausting. I've got my hand on my forehead in the dramatic Morrissey fashion. Anyway, hope you enjoy this, friends. Pick up a course at the Academic Agency, and I'll see you tomorrow for the return of the deepest lore when we've got a special guest coming on, joining myself and Horace, joining myself and Simon Roberts for the start of Adam Curtis's magnum opus, Hypernormalization. We've got a special guest who will be joining us then. Tomorrow at noon. So long, everyone.
What goes on in this town is none of your business.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Then maybe you shouldn't be living here!
Well, that's easily fixed.